Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Before I get started, it is the 99th minute of One Heat Minute. And my guest today is a sort of improv comedy specialist that has been in a bunch of stuff you might have seen. You would have seen him possibly in Orange is the New Black or Search Party. I'm excited because he's part of the Upright Citizens Brigade or UCB in New York, and one of my fondest memories ever of visiting New York was like stumbling into the UCB and seeing like murderers rows of comic lineups that you see for like $5, and which is amazing. But what is great about this show is that heat obsessives in the world reach out when they hear about it, and that's awesome. This particular heat obsessive and improv comedy specialist has made a film, a short film called The Spirit of Heat. And in that short film, which is, I think, part of a collaboration with him and his friends because they're in the middle of making another film, he said something that I had never picked up about this movie, which I can't wait for him to explore. And it's a really exciting revelation. So you get excited with new people just bringing their new lens on this movie. And that's one of the joys of it. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mr. Connor Ratliff to One Heat Minute. Connor, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Oh, I am excited and honored to be a part of this. I learned of your podcast on Twitter, and someone else pointed it out to me, and like, have you seen this? And I immediately started just devouring episodes, and which it's an insane podcast to binge listen to because it's very long, but each episode is about a very short thing that is about a very long thing. It's great, and. Yeah, that film, I had actually been making a few years ago. I made this weird Christmas special called The Spirit of Ratliff. And while we were filming it, I started talking about the film Heat. And one of the people who was filming it turned his camera off and he's like, this is boring. But the other camera guy was like, no, this is interesting. And I talked about Heat for so much that when we were done, I said, give me that footage. I'm going to make it into its own thing called The Spirit of Heatliff, which is a little and it's I think the thing that I said – I'm assuming it was the thing about the time structure of the film,
the
right?
The time structure of the film. I had never thought about it in those terms.
When this movie came out in 95, I remember like Casino was the film people were excited about. That was like the big dog, and has ended up kind of the two becoming the lesser sort of cult film.
Yes.
Like Casino is the film that people sort of discover and they're like, oh, this is good. But Heat is the classic from that year.
Yes.
And I saw Heat in the theater right before I was getting ready to go to school in England. I was going to drama school in Liverpool. And And Heat came out a couple months later. It came out, I think, in January of 96. And it was during the period where I just, you know, I'd moved to another country and I was so homesick. And what I found was I wanted to see Heat again, but also it brought me – I saw it four times in the theater on original release, which I've never done that with any other movie. And part of it was that when I was in the movie theater, it was like 3 hours where my sense memory was like, oh, I'm back home 2 months ago.
Yes.
You know? And the fourth time I saw it, you know, when you see a three-hour movie, you know, that's that – and you see it that many times in the matter of like a month and a half or so – the fourth time I watched it was the most like analytical that I've ever been watching a movie, where I just started looking at I wasn't emotionally involved that viewing. I was just like a computer process. I was like, my view screen was like the Terminator, what the Terminator sees, just processing like what's in every frame, kind of like what you do in every episode of this podcast. And I started counting. It starts at night and then it goes to day. And I'm like, and then you see a little bit at night, and it is the last week in the life of Neil McCauley.
Oh my goodness. When Spirit of Heat said that, I was like, oh my God.
Every day and every night.
In 100 episodes, more than 100 episodes that have been recorded, we just never stumbled upon that. And I was like, as soon as you said, I'd love to be on the show, I'm like, I must get Connor on the show before... like before some of these episodes happen, because he's stumbled on it and it was it's just been floating out there in the world and it hasn't been a reading of the film that I've ever thought of before.
Because my original impression of it was like, oh, this is like a heist film, but it's also kind of one of those like Robert Altman films where it's like Shortcuts or Nashville, where, you know, you see all these little side characters. And to me, it felt scattershot almost, where it's like, oh, why did we spend so much time with, you know, this character or that character?
Yes.
And then by the fourth time I was like, well, it has that, but it's also incredibly disciplined and structured while looking chaotic, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Connor's looking at me going, oh my God, this movie. He's just like, his hands are on his head. He's ready to go. So I thought it was kind of important to get this episode in with Connor at the 99th episode, so we have that perspective, because the next two episodes are the 100th episode featuring the cinematographer Dante Spinotti, so you guys can look forward to that, including Connor, who's on a rapid binge through this podcast, followed up by the amazing actor from movies like Predator and Mandy, and also a great television director in his own right, who got his start directing TV with Michael Mann on Miami Vice, Bill Duke is on the show. And he's getting to talk really around that incredible Dennis Haysbert minute where we see up and coming. So this is where we are. We're going to watch this minute together, Connor and I. And it starts, as I said, with Henry Rollins' pursed lips, blue steel moment. Then we're going to finish off in that little cafe. I think I've got I'm going to read out, I think, the name of the cafe. I'm going to find it in my – it's a friend of mine put it in my Instagram mentions. They were actually at this cafe and said, Blake, this is, you know, a pilgrimage for you. You must go to this place. Where are we?
There should be heat tours of LA. I don't know if anyone in Los Angeles does this, but you should be able to go to all the locations and experience it.
I feel like we're just one step away from that actually happening. I'm gonna find that. I'm gonna bring it up in a couple of minutes. But let's go into this minute, and Connor and I are gonna watch it. You guys are gonna listen along, and then we're gonna come back and talk about it.
Recognize the grill man? Yeah. Awesome. Deep black. How's with Bobby Rush?
They got my break yet, man.
Cisco and Poncho didn't show. Pull out the garbage. Knock out the back. Take your break later.
Piece of shit. Pick up!
Where the hell is he? I want to check the slot for the work car.
So did I. Yeah.
It's a good minute.
It's a good minute.
I mean, there are no bad minutes. That's the great thing. It's where it is on the spectrum of how good the minute. And that's a good minute.
It is good because I find that the little there's quite a few reaction shots that happen as like these beautiful little fade out moments in each. You know, I just did one, the 96 episode with Zach Hepburn. He's an Aussie film critic and he's a film programmer and runs one of the great institutions, theatre called the Astor Theatre in Melbourne, in southern Australia, in Victoria. And he got the reaction shots of Vincent Hanna and Neil McCauley, so Pacino and De Niro at the end of the coffee house scene. So he there's no more dialogue, but it's just that sort of smile / pursed lips. And we get this in that previous scene. It's very sort of tense scene. You see Wayne Grove's manipulation, but here at the beginning, you get Hugh Benny looking over at Van Sant like, I don't know what to do. And then Wayne Grove just sort of smiling, his charm, he's totally in control. And that's where we kick this minute off.
It's like a Bugs Bunny expression almost that Wayne Grove have. It's a real ain't I a stinker kind of look. He's just like so. He's so pleased with himself. What a bad boy he is. He is.
He's taking a perverse pleasure. But this is what's so funny about him. He's having such a good time, and he's nearer to death than most.
Yes.
Like surely he has double-crossed other people before. That's what I always think. The more I watch Kevin Gage, he's having such a fun time, but he's definitely done this before. He's just flying at the seat of his pants. He does not know what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Where does he get that confidence?
I don't know.
It's tremendous.
In the subplot of this movie, he could be a serial killer who's just been getting away with it. So he's just happily getting away with stuff.
Yeah. And I think in that character, I think was part of what I originally perceived. He's such a chaotic character that I think my original impression of the movie was that it was chaotic.
Yes.
And it really is a movie that the movie isn't chaotic, but there's chaos contained within it. But the movie is disciplined and structured. And the movie is content to let you believe that it is chaotic, but it knows exactly what it's doing.
And then we move over. You're speaking of one moment of chaos to another is mm-hmm. where at this restaurant, and we're waiting. At this moment, we kind of really don't know what we're waiting for, but all the guys are finally in suits again. So we're like, oh, okay, something is a little bit odd here. We see Chris, you know, the picture of concentration. And I love here, there's a massive contrast. And you don't see it in, you know, until you analyze the minute. There's a beautiful moment. Neil just sort of is looking for Trejo, turns around, and he spots Donald Breeden, so Dennis Haysbert, and he just makes him in like 1 second. And he turns around to Chris and goes, do you see who the real man is? And Chris has a like takes his glasses off and has like a real intense look at him for like it feels like 5 or 6 seconds of the minute, and he's like no.
Yeah, it is interesting how much in these little moments the characters are so distinctly defined that I think when I've watched this in the past I've always been sort of fixated on Val Kilmer in this scene because he looks troubled in this scene. Like he looks exhausted. He looks like he's like it almost looks like we have in servicing all of the various stories while we've been spending time with Vincent Hanna and Neil, we've been spending time with away from Val Kilmer. It feels like his last 8 hours were rough. Like whatever happened, it feels like he's been going through it. And you don't have time in the movie to see everything that happens with everybody.
No.
And watching it now, it's interesting how, you know, the three of those characters each have a different degree of urgency to what's about to happen with De Niro obviously being he's a little fidgety. He's concerned, but he's not panicking, but he is looking around. He's worried and he's figuring, like even his spotting the grill cook is not just a casual observation. It seems like it's one in the moment, but then we'll come to realize it's part of the discipline. He is planning ahead. He's looking.
He's put that on the plan as a backup instantly.
He's looking for fire exits, basically.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Kilmer is completely, he's just, he needs this more than the other two.
And it's great because he's contrasted with Michael Torito, so Tom Sizemore in the scene. And Sizemore's like relaxed. He's got both of his arms spread out. He's like,
rubs his hands together like he does that little like hot diggity kind of move. He is fine. Like he's not that nervous. No. And he's the one who's like choosing to do this even though he doesn't need to.
Yes.
And he has the energy of a man who's like excited about the day they're about to have. Whereas the other two are concerned, you know. It's also interesting because this is one of those minutes where there are some things said that I looked them up on a website that has like the dialogue from the movie. I could have just turned on subtitles or something. But it has lines that I'm sure in my mind I've never really – it's almost like watching a foreign movie without the subtitles. There are lines that I know I've never actually processed what the names are that are being said.
Yes.
Like when he says, you recognize the grill man? No. Folsom, D-Block, housed with Dobie Rush.
Yes. Housed with Dobie Rush.
I've never processed the name Dobie Rush. I've just known he's talking about when he knows him from prison.
And what's good is for everyone who's a casual viewer. For everyone who's a casual viewer, like Dobie Rush means nothing. How are we spell? How's it spelling Dobie in the script? I'm going to Google it. I guarantee you it's a real criminal.
D-O-B-I-E.
Dobie Rush.
Like
this is some
like Dobie Gillis, like the old sitcom. That Bob Denver was in. Housed with Dobie Rush. And then, like 3 seconds after that, we're in the kitchen. And he says, I ain't got my break yet. And Bud Cort says, Cisco and Pancho didn't show up. So we have three characters dropped in a matter of seconds that are part of the. If they start, you know, if Michael Mann decides to pull a James Cameron Avatar and announces, are they still working on that book, that novel that is supposed to happen in the Heat universe, right?
The prequel book. Something? The prequel book.
Dobie Rush. It says these are all characters that are in play.
100%. 100% they're in play. And Don Breeden's a character in there too, for sure.
Yeah. Cisco and Pancho didn't show up.
Cisco and Pancho.
What are they doing? Why didn't they show up? Are they together? Are they in cahoots?
Are they crooks?
Is there another?
Are they crooks or are they just random, like employees that are just being able to bend the rules because they know that poor Don Breeden has to turn up, otherwise he gets bounced back to jail.
It almost feels like Disney is gonna at some point when they run out of other things to consume, they're gonna buy Heat and then we'll get a Heat movie every year while they.
I would just say this. I hope they don't for the sake of podcasting.
They don't. Oh, yes.
This will be never.
The number of minutes they can add to your workload.
Yeah, it's significant.
If they did a web series, it could add 20 episodes, 20 episodes a year.
The ones that get me is you don't ever think about we haven't really had to think about, and we've talked a lot about in this show, you know, about the rich character backstories that man sort of makes his actors write for themselves, or he sort of prescribes, this is where I think you've been, and then they go to the jails and they do interviews with real crooks to sort of, you know, see if they can be a sponge to any sort of, you know, tics or affectations or just know these things. But it's like one of those first times where it's like Folsom B-Wing exists. And I guarantee, and I can't find him right now in some Googling, but I'm sure people listening kind of know, but Dobie Rush would be a Chicago criminal from the 1970s. Would probably be the real name of a Chicago criminal from the 1970s. And in which case, he's then just sort of layering in some of that real texture that these are guys that the real Neil McCauley would have known. And sort of man's just taking that sort of elegant dramatic license to sort of chuck a few things in there. And that's what it is. You know, it wouldn't be surprised if Neil McCauley's real partner's name might not be like Dobie Rush or something like that as we're talking about it.
Yeah. A quick Google search. The first thing that obviously comes up is the Heat quote. Yeah. That's the thing that comes up first. But the second thing is there are two people who with Facebook profiles named Dobie Rush. neither of them have photos. So I'm gonna make a wild guess that both of these were made by Heat fans. There's someone out there who's creating Facebook files of – obscure characters within the Heat universe.
Well, and another game to play at home, folks, is for the next few times you get your coffee and they ask what your name is, Dobie Rush, Cisco, and Punch need to be alternate names at Starbucks for you over the next few weeks while you're after you're listening to this show. So go nuts with it, absolutely.
Yeah. It's interesting because this is, you know, there's the, because I wasn't sure when I was looking at which minute we were going to look at. I told you I had, because of the various frame rates and things like that, there were different minutes that I was looking at. And within a very short span of time, like, this is one of the minutes that is tense but calm.
Yes.
You know, they're just sitting there. There's no immediate threat, but there's a lot of dread in this minute.
Yes.
Because it starts with menace, because we see Henry Rollins, we see Wengro, and that's the threat of, like, trouble is going to be caused. And then we cut to the people who are going to be at the receiving end of that trouble.
Yes.
And they're concerned because they have this, you know, there's the thing about, and I don't think I ever processed this line either. They're talking about Trejo, and they say, "Where the hell is he? I want to check the slot for the work car." So did I. That they were looking to see where the car was parked, right? For the
So the slot for the work car is, they've determined where the work car is going to be parked for them to go and meet up with it. But he was going to be there once he'd lost the police tail.
Yeah.
Once you made sure that there were no police tail on him at all,
yeah,
he's there.
Yeah.
Because they're assuming they're there, he's meant to pull up. So if we think about it logically over the course of it, is they've dumped all of the police surveillance. So there should be no one on him, which is why I think, you know, probably feeds into some of the upcoming minutes where Neil is, like, getting even more frustrated because he shouldn't have any tail. But if he does, just in the rare chance because he's the driver, they want him to park in that slot and signify that he's going to be there on time. So right now, what's even cool, I try and take myself back as well. I know it's really difficult for even both of us, but it's like, I don't think I would have registered that this is the big heist that they're doing right now. It doesn't feel like the beginning of a massive heist, but really this is the minute that is the beginning of this huge heist moment. They're just sitting at a cafe looking pretty casually. And if you weren't really looking at how Neil's fidgeting or how intense Chris is, like, firing himself up, ready to go, you would just sort of go, oh, they're just in a cafe. It's only when you start looking at the suits, the urgency, and really when he propositions Breeden that you're like, oh, okay, this is the beginning of this massive arc in the story.
Yeah, it's also interesting, like, because I'm sure, like, I don't know the exact dates on when this would have, like, originally gone into production. And I have to confess, I've never watched L.A. Takedown. I've never watched the made-for-TV.
You would have a lot of fun, I think.
I've always sort of imagine I'm going to watch it at some point, but there's a part of me that doesn't want to see a rough draft version of it. Like, there's a part of me that has just resisted that over the years because I still like being able to watch it and get sucked into the feeling of it. Now I sort of feel like, having listened to the podcast, I have to watch LA Takedown because I've already given over to the picking apart of the bones and stretching. We're just, like, pulling the muscle and everything apart and seeing, like, how does this thing work? So I feel like now I have to see that. But this, I assume, is too close on the heels of, even though it's a year after Pulp Fiction came out, that this would have been already in the pipeline before. There's no way that this could be in any way responding to Pulp Fiction because there wouldn't be enough time, I don't think.
No, maybe not. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about it as sort of a diner scene that was relating to Pulp. But yeah, no, I think they were well into production early.
Yeah.
Early 95.
And there could be, I'm assuming, a similar scene in L.A. Takedown in a way that it's just a natural thing that you're in L.A. This is the kind of place that people meet up or wait or whatever.
Yes.
But there is something about the way that this film – the way films are kind of in a conversation, a natural dialogue with one another, and that I know it's been, I think it's been you guys have talked a little bit about this, I think. But just the way that, these, like this scene, watching these professionals in this diner are very much the opposite of Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer in the opening of Pulp Fiction. Two people who on a whim decide to hold a diner up for a hostage and burglary and whatnot. And it's interesting. It takes me back a little bit to, you know, like Mr. Pink and Reservoir Dogs talking about being a professional.
Yes.
Like, isn't anyone here a fucking professional is kind of the – and this movie is really just – it's so interesting how it's not a – this life is not a source – I mean, with the exception – I mean, obviously, like, Tom Sizemore gets a thrill out of it. But for the most part, the people in this movie are doing – they're doing jobs, and they get satisfaction from it. But it's interesting to me. I've wondered, you know, because this is such a – you tell people about this movie who haven't seen it. It sounds like a very macho movie.
Yes.
You know? It's a lot of gunfire, a lot, you know, some cops and robbers, and it's all dudes. I mean, there are some strong female characters, but they're very much at the supporting edges of the story, you know?
Definitely.
And it's almost hard to imagine a contemporary version of this movie in which the two cops are they are in this movie. And yet I was thinking about this. I'm like, I'm not an especially macho guy. I don't particularly like, you know, movies I think of as like, oh, that's a, you know, like it's not a thing that
it's not like I'm Predator. Really it's not like Predator. Yeah. Like that's a, like the Predator is like the quintessential macho action movie.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason is this is a movie that all of the surface elements of it are macho.
Yes.
But it's mostly a movie about how these guys feel about all of this. It's a very emotional movie. It's about how sad they all are.
Yes.
You know, that Al Pacino is a guy who would make a great dad and a great husband, but he can't. And he's sad about it. Like,
yes.
Not to skip ahead to all the way to the ending, but like the last shot of Pacino's face at the end is not a triumphant shot.
No.
It's he's looking off into the distance and he's sad because he knows he has a whole life that he can, he could give into it and be maybe a different version of him would be happy, but he can't. And Neil McCauley, his whole story is that he wants this happy life that he sees other people have and he can't.
And it feels fake to him. It feels so disingenuous to him. That's what's so beautiful and nuanced about De Niro's performance as Neil is that he's like, he wants it. And when he's in it, he's like, it's almost like, this isn't me. This goes against everything that in my philosophy. It's really funny that you said that because a great guest who was on the show, Mr. Kyle Turner, who's a New York based writer, for a bunch of different publications, including Paste. And he wrote the other day in a tweet, I spent a lot of time avoiding Heat because it looked like macho BS. And the people I knew who liked it in college, I wanted to push into a lake. But Heat is beautiful, sad, thoughtful, ruminative melodrama.
Yeah.
And I think he perfectly nailed that. He also said thank you to me for making him a convert and this show for getting him on. But it's like, I think that's the kind of the crux of it, really. That's the whole genesis. There really is quite a melodramatic movie when you come under it. And Mann himself has been quoted many times to say, no, it's a drama. This is a drama about people.
Yeah.
And they just happen that their professions are, you know, very exciting. exciting.
And in many cases, the lowest moments that we see any of the characters experience don't have to do with being killed. They have to do with being heartbroken or unhappy.
Yes.
You know, that there are characters who live who have worse ends than characters who die. And there are characters who die that the death is not the worst thing that happens to them.
No.
And it really is just like, this is a movie about tough guys, but it's really a movie about unhappy sad guys who don't know how to make a happy life. And it doesn't matter whether they are on the good side of things or the bad side of things. The cops are as unhappy as the criminals, and the criminals don't get any extra happiness from breaking the rules.
No.
You know, so it really is like and even – I mean, it's an interesting question to ponder. Like, are there any characters in this movie that you would consider it by the end of the movie that character is a winner? You know?
There's really not a single winner whatsoever. The only mild winner, you might say, just because he's allowed to be alive, is Chris Chehalis. He gets to walk away pretty safe. But
he's devastated.
He's devastated. But he's alive. I think he's
rather less happy than Teresa. I think he's less happy than Trejo. I think I think his ending is in many ways the saddest ending, because where does he go? What does he do? I mean, it's just
the sun rises and sets with her, and she's like,
even among the minor characters, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to see where the hope is in this movie. You know, like, it's almost like if you want that, you have to go to another movie. You know,
but I think that's what keeps us. A huge reason is that people go back. It's that rumination. It's like going, you know, we all have our professional or personal obsessions, and it's like, and they're trying to balance those two things and find time for personal fulfillment. These are huge things. And so when you go back to this movie over and over again, you just get all of these little samples of these people just trying to balance a life, like trying to make a life. You know, Don Breeden, who we just talked about and who's in an upcoming scene, he's like, he's just trying to balance getting out of jail and just trying to just put his head down and go back to work. And even that can't work. Like, working in a diner, he's being bullied like he's in a jail yard, you know. And you know, Charlene, they've got the house, they've got all this, and Chris just can't, by impulse, just pisses his money away. You know, there are all these beautiful contradictions or these beautiful collisions of things where someone genuinely does want to improve. They've got the best support possible. They've got a great wife, and yet they just stumble into Bud Cort's diner, and all he wants to do is just take your money and boss you around.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, like, Bud Cort is one of, you know, in a movie full of, and what's, does Bud Cort's character have a name?
I'll find it.
I'm looking to see if he does on here. I mean, scrolling this movie on IMDb is it's a workout for your thumb. There's just so many names in this.
Selenko is his name.
Selenko.
Selenko. Restaurant manager, Selenko.
Yeah. He, you know, he gets pushed over, you know. That's about the worst that happens to him.
Yeah, maybe he gets out of it okay. He got a kickback for a short amount of time.
I do. It is interesting watching this clip now, because the thought that occurred to me was like, that's the character. If I was going to get cast in a movie, in a version of this movie, that would be the character that I would be up for, is the diner, the restaurant manager who's an asshole.
If I was ever an actor such as yourself, I'd just be praying for Schwartz, you know, the guy in Vincent Hanna's team that basically has like one line, gets his arm broken. Like, I want to be that guy that just stands in the back while Michael T. Williamson and Ted Levine and you know, they're doing all the heavy lifting. And Wes Studi just killing it. And I'm just standing in the back sort of looking shocked at everything that Vincent says. That's what I'd be hoping for.
And I think it's mostly because, I mean, it's a lot to ask for the movie to delve at all into Selenko's life, because you're already, Donald Breeden is already a detour from the main core of the movie.
Yes.
You know, it's already the movie it's like a beautiful little short story that another movie wouldn't have time for.
Yes.
Which is to the point where up until this scene, when you're watching the movie, you don't know why he's in this movie, you know?
Yes.
Every scene with Donald Breeden prior to this is almost like you could be like, did I change the channel?
Yes.
Because it's when De Niro recognizes him as a viewer, you go, oh, he's going to get looped into this somehow. Like, you don't know yet, but like, this is the scene where it's signaling to you, dear viewer, those scenes that you've been watching earlier where you get to know and have some feeling for this man and his he's struggling to start a new life, and he's not getting a fair shake in this new job. Like, because he comes into that new job and he's like, I'm a great grill man. He's enthusiastic. He's positive. So we see him as a person who's trying.
Yes.
It's in some ways it's the movie's, maybe the movie's cruelest vein is introducing us to a character whom we like, introducing us to his partner whom we like, and see that they have good intentions, and his entire function really is to see all that so that it ultimately can be taken away from us.
Yes.
And so all of these things, it really is kind of like the second De Niro clocks him, it's a, oh no.
And
we don't imagine it's going to end with him having bags of cash, you know?
No. And one thing that's even more amazing, and I love that you pointed out that spot, was that it's kind of been imperceptible, his diner, up to this point. The way that it was shot before, we were looking into the kitchen through Bud Court. Mm-hmm. There's that one night where he's in a bar that's close by to the restaurant that's not actually the restaurant, or it might be the restaurant, but he's sitting in the diner and everything's dark and you can't see it. And so in this moment, right up until De Niro clocks him, you're exactly right. You're like, oh, this is a new location. We've never been here before, but it is potentially the third time we've actually been in this spot. And so that when he clocks him, exactly, there's this quick second where you go, oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And especially then seeing Bud Court give him that shit. You're like, oh, God, here, this is only going to end one way.
Yeah. And now, the diner that they were in earlier in the movie with Wengro, is that this diner?
No.
That's the same diner? No, it's a different diner.
Completely different.
Because it's nighttime, so I didn't know, like, I couldn't remember if for some reason this was the place they always go. That would seem sloppy somehow.
Yes.
Imagine they have either a rotation of LA diners that has been meticulously, almost like an algorithm, like, we'll go to this one, we'll go to this one. Or if they just never go to the same place twice.
I would almost say that the latter. They never go to the same place twice. They want to know where it is. They want to know the lay of the land, but they probably never go there twice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting because we've seen him as this person with a genuine desire to start a clean new life, to start make an honest living. We've seen how much he wants it.
Yes.
And the new thing that we learn in this minute is Neil McCauley sees him, and we trust Neil McCauley as a judge of character up to this point. Like, Neil is so disciplined that if Neil sees you and has like a good, you know, he has a good vibe when he says it, like, you're right, it's him, Folsom, D Block, House with Toby Rush. He says it, even though there's no lines that say like, he's a good guy or you can trust him or any of those. But you can tell from the way he says those lines.
He's going through a resume. He's like, oh, he's a good guy. Like, how's with W. Rush? Folsom, B-Wing. He's tough. He's done some time. He's done some hard time. He's one of our guys. He's one of our potential crew members.
And I think it's interesting how economical the dialogue is, that they didn't feel the need to write, like, anything that said, like, he's a good guy. Or, like, because it's not necessary.
No.
It's all there in De Niro's expression.
Yes.
And it really is, you know, it's such a, this is such a perfect part for De Niro at that point in his career. In some ways, it's sort of like, I feel like this is the best De Niro ever looks in a movie. Like,
I agree.
He's in like really good shape. Because he's still got that peak handsomeness
of De Niro.
Because he's the Max Cady-ness of him has worn off.
It's just
the insanity of being that in shape has worn off to a natural sort of a reasonable. Because I don't like to imagine that Neil McCauley works out. I don't like thinking of him having an exercise routine. I like thinking of Neil McCauley. I think he eats right and he knows to get in his like 10,000 steps. You know, like, I don't like the idea of Neil Cawley like in a gym exercising.
No, I think he's got like a weird garage, and it's very old school, where there's like one token weights bench and a few dumbbells that he and the team use only just so that they can still point a rifle well and things like that. It's definitely not, he's not walking into Fitness First in LA or a Virgin Active. It's definitely not who he is.
I would watch because I, here's the other thing. The reason that I something started spinning in my head after I made the joke about Disney buying this and making a bunch of Heat movies is that right now, as we speak, that movie that Scorsese is making for Netflix, which apparently is using a lot of CGI yes. to make or effects or whatever to give us younger footage, which we've already seen a little of in movies like Joy. The there's clips in there of like Stanley and Iris era De Niro.
Yes.
They look a little strange, but because it's strange to see him in new footage where it's like, you know, but I would watch a plotless movie. Once the technology gets to the point where there's no uncanny valley about it, I would watch a plotless movie just about all the different things that all the different books that Neil McCauley has gotten over the years. Because you see, he gets that book of about metals because they're going to look at this metal place. That had me thinking that I was like, I wonder how many times he has read a book because there's just a reason. Like, I imagine for Keeping Fit, at one point he read one book that was like, here's what you do. He clocked the information. He threw the book away. You know, like, I bet he's read a book a week for his whole life about whatever. I imagine we don't see that after he has that conversation, because he's learning, like that scene where he's asking, how do you get all this information, to Tom Noonan?
Yes.
He's a genuinely, he never stops learning in this movie. I think in his life, I mean, this is a movie about the day when he finally stops learning,
this is the scene where he does the most un-Neil McCauley thing imaginable, which is he's already had this job look like it could go pear-shaped in so many mm-hmm. ways.
Yeah.
And right now it's like the most improvisation he could have is having to ditch a driver.
Yeah.
Which is critically important, and he just does it.
Yeah.
And that's where you're like, there's been so many times in this podcast, and people who are listening are going to be like, "This, you guys have said this many times." It's like, this is the turning point for Neil. But I don't actually think it's a singular turning point. It's like this set of cumulative turning points for him where he's denying his instincts or denying the discipline and just goes off and does this thing that's wrong. And in this moment when he clocks him, he's like, yes, he did has the backup plan. Yes, he's the right kind of guy to do it. But it's like, I sometimes imagine, like, what happens if Dom Breeden's mental fortitude right now is that right in that moment is better. And it's like, there's no movie, but at the same time, it's like, does he still go ahead with his job? Do they try and figure it out with three people? That feels like so much more like a cowboy. You know, he is that guy who's like, do you see me doing thrill seeker liquor store holdups with a Bond and Lewis tattoo on my chest? Like, he becomes that guy in that moment if they go off with three guys. So in this, he's like, you know, he is actually being a thrill seeker. He's, you know, to get a brand new driver in, that's a thrill seeker move.
You have just said something to me that I've never thought of before, and it's right in my wheelhouse, and it was there the whole time in Plainview, which is an entirely different way of viewing this movie, which is the way I'm going to think about it the next time I watch it all the way through, which is this movie is about the difference between improv comedy and sketch comedy. Vincent Hanna is improv comedy, and Neil McCauley is sketch. And when Neil McCauley goes wrong is when he tries to incorporate improv.
Yes.
He lives a life where it's like, let's write these jokes out. Let's make sure we introduce the premise in the first page. Let's get the game of the scene laid out. Make sure that we got a solid button at the end of it. You get it all worked out. Let's put it on its feet. Let's rewrite it. Make sure we've got it. And Vincent Hanna could not be more the spirit of improv than he is. He is a guy who busts through the door, the chickens go running, and he is playing it by ear. If you say Phoenix, he starts singing by the time I get to Phoenix.
She'll be rising.
He is improv. And at the end of this film, one of them sticks to their discipline and wins. If Neil McCauley had stuck true to sketch comedy, he would have gotten away, but he crossed the disciplines.
I cannot wait for the people of the UCB in New York City for the just plethora of heat sketches that are going to come to compare sketch comedy and improv comedy over and over again. You've got 170 minutes to unpack and build some great sketches there.
Yeah, because you're right. It is a moment of improvisation when he decides we're going to we're not going to do the thing as we planned. We're going to play it by ear. We're going to incorporate this new element. We're gonna yes and the idea of this grill man. And yeah, and it's so fascinating when you watch this movie and you see the moments where pivotal mistakes are made. Because once you've there, because in some cases it's not even like you watch it once and then you watch it a second time and you see all the mistakes. Sometimes you watch it 20 times and it's on the 21st time that you're like, oh, if they just done this,
yes,
then it all would have worked out. Because and some of them are huge big moments, but you're right, this is a big moment. This is one of those moments where they're all sitting there, they know it's a bad idea, they get a call, well, that's not in this minute, but like the phone call that is about to happen is going to be the thing that could tell them it's time to like call it. And it's all there in De Niro's body language at the beginning of the shot. He's fidgety.
Yes.
And it's his inner torment because he knows this should be a no.
Yes.
But he wants this. He wants to do this so that he can, you know, go away and start this new life. It's also interesting because on some level, you get the sense that, like, he wants this life with Amy Brenneman. But you also get the sense that on some level, he knows that, let's say they walk away from this score and they go their separate ways, the way he said that's the smart play right now. Let's say he takes whatever money he has and he goes away with Amy Brenneman and he doesn't, you know, he starts a new life.
Neil's better set up than anyone in his career. Yeah. Right now, he's better set up than anyone in his career. There's no question.
There's something in him. I can't imagine a scenario where he follows through on that life.
No, he's retired for a few years and he's back at it.
Yeah.
There's no way that he's retired forever. He's not the retired forever guy.
Yeah. And I mean, part of he wants to imagine a world where he could do this, where he means it, where he is going to do that. Part of me likes to imagine. I think the most optimistic read that you could have of this movie, and I think it's legitimate because we don't know what happens.
Yes.
Is that Pacino does this, and that look at the end is him realizing this is hollow. This brings me no joy. And he's going to go back to his wife and his stepdaughter, and they are going to live a happy life. And he can just casually be a police officer and not be obsessive about it. I mean, you can. That is one reading that in my best mood I would like to have. But I think everything in the every fiber of this movie seems to scratch against that. You know, it seems when you're watching a scene like this, you can see the way it's got to be. Even I don't think I knew when I was watching it the first time. I don't think I knew where it was going. You know, I don't think I think the movie throws you off the track. It throws you off the scent on first viewing in so many ways that just keeping up with the what's going on is a big thing.
And especially, you know, to sort of foreshadow a couple of minutes is like there's that great moment with Vincent later on where he's given up. Mm-hmm. He's given up on the whole thing. He's like, that's it. He's gone. Goes to the hotel. That's it. He's gone. This movie does that for us so many times because we've kind of the discipline is so ingrained in us that you're like, oh, Neil's going to go. It's done. He's got away.
Yeah.
He's going to be the one to get away. How's he going to?
There's a it's very easy to do. You can do a lot of different fan edits of this movie just by stopping it at various points.
Yes.
That would be a great one. They're gone.
Credits.
There is a thing.
Just while you're looking that up, the great fan edit of all time is like, you got to stop when you spot the heat coming around the corner, and it's like literally the moment that Captain Hydration sits down in the truck and makes that noise that flags Neil to the police's presence. That's the smash cut ending of the movie. Because Neil actually accepted his discipline in that moment, he spotted the heat around the corner. Done. Finished. Yeah. See ya. New town. New life.
There's a YouTube channel. Have you heard of the Walk of Life Project?
No.
This is it's a YouTube channel where it's a WOOL project, and it's basically this guy named Peter Salamone did a thing where he ends movies with the Dire Straits song Walk of Life. and I looked it up, and Heat does have if you look up Heat ending Walk of Life project, there is an ending where it lines up so well with like The Matrix is a really good one because it has that like slow keyboard intro.
Yes.
So you can layer that. You can pick your moment to layer that over the final moments of a movie. And then the crucial thing is where you do that cut to, like directed by Michael Mann or, you know, like, as soon as we're done with that, I'm going to go watch the Heat. I've seen it before. I'd forgotten about it, but it's a pretty delightful, project that, somebody put together.
Well, especially for this show, Connor Ratliff, I think that's the perfect place to end this conversation, because what I'm going to do is, instead of our usual outro music, I'm going to outro the show with Dire Straits' Walk of Life to end this, the 99th episode of One Heat Minute, and slightly freak people out. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the 99th episode of One Heat Minute. Connor, thank you so much for being a part of the show. You've got to come back.
Thank you. You've
got
to come back.
We've got so much more to talk about. So we're going to stay in touch, and Connor's going to be back. We're on the downhill slope of this show.
You're going to have to start over from the. You're going to have to watch it backwards.
Not watching it backwards. We'll have to figure something out. But we're on the downhill slope of the show. We've got so many great guests lined up. We've got so many great episodes. Connor, thank you so much for being a part of the show. Guys, Connor Ratliff on the Twitters. You can find him there. That's probably the best spot. Anywhere else they need to go, Connor?
Yeah, Connor Ratliff. CONNORRATLIFF.
Perfect. That's it. So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of One Eat Minute. We'll catch you on another episode, the 100th episode, with the inimitable legend, Dante Spinotti, just around the corner.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.